Like in the previous lecture, we derived this relationship for the particles that were absorbed by the black hole in this Penrose process, that the angular momentum absorbed by the black hole was greater than the energy divided by omega h. Omega h is the horizon angular velocity of the black hole. So it turns out this is actually a special case of the black hole area theorem. It was actually first proved by Hawking in 1971. So what this theorem states is that the area of a black hole horizon can never decrease. It can remain constant or increase. And let me write that down. So I'm going to use delta ABH here to note the area of the black hole. The change in area of the black hole has to be greater than or equal to zero. And this theorem in particular has some assumptions that come with it. In particular, it assumes cosmic censorship. And so I briefly mentioned this idea that whenever the space-time breaks down, that has to be hidden behind a horizon, that the space-time is sort of asymptotically predictable. That's cosmic censorship, and it also assumes energy condition, in particular the null energy condition. So,
in my notes, I have is the opposite sign of the inequality.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Yep. Yeah, so to show you how this is actually true, let's calculate the area of our Kerr black hole. So, we're going to restrict to just the two surface that determines the black hole horizon at a specific time and calculate its area. So in that case, we just have sort of two metric determined by the phi and theta components. And we want to evaluate this at the horizon. And if we can just use the fact that if we plug in these coefficients at the horizon, get that. So just plug that in, do the integral, and we get the following expression. Okay. And of course r plus is just the radius at which the horizon is. So just to remind ourselves, by that. And so we can, if we just rewrite this, in terms of the mass and angular momentum of the black hole, we get the following quantity. Here, this is the black hole angular momentum. Right, everyone with me so far? All right, so now what we want to do is vary the area, or see basically how the area changes. We make a small change in the black hole's mass and angular momentum. And for convenience, I'll just take the 8 pi and put it on the left-hand side. We're just varying that quantity with respect to M and J. And a little bit of simplification. So we collect in the delta J and the delta M terms, and then we can simplify this one a little bit further. And doesn't really know what that quantity is the inverse of.
Horizon frequency.
Yeah, exactly.
1 by horizon frequency.
That's the inverse horizon frequency. Okay, so so we can just simplify this a little bit more. Yeah, so now we're ready to show the connection between the change in the black hole's area and this relationship between the change in angular momentum, or the amount of angular momentum and energy for particles that could fall down the black hole. That's equivalent to changing the black hole's angular momentum and mass by a little bit. So in order for when that particle to be absorbed, for it to increase the area as opposed to decreasing it, we need this quantity to be positive, right? Or at least greater than or equal to zero. So that just gives us exactly the same condition we had before. Yeah, so we can see that these allowed trajectory to fall into the black hole carrying some small delta M and delta J are exactly the ones that keep the black holes horizon area increasing as opposed to the ones that, if they were absorbed, would decrease the black hole. So we can define another mass for the black hole called the irreducible mass. And we just define that in terms of the area of the black hole horizon. So since we call this irreducible because since we're claiming that this area has to can never be reduced, that means this mass associated with the black hole can also never be reduced. So for a Schwarzschild black hole, can anyone guess what the irreducible mass is going to be? We're just gonna, for the area, we'll have 4 pi. Yep, exactly. We just have 4 pi times the Schwarzschild radius. 3 pi here. And that'll just give us the mass of the black hole. But now let's do the maximally spinning case. So in that case, I'm going to have the radius is just the black hole mass squared, and so is A. We have 8 pi here. And that means this irreducible mass can be 1 over the square root of 2. So we can kind of think of the difference between the total mass of the black hole and this irreducible mass of the black hole as the amount of energy that sort of in principle we could liberate from the black hole without violating this area increase law. You can also think of that, you know, since that energy is kind of associated with the spin of the black hole, we can also sort of define this difference as associated to the rotational energy of the black hole. There's the difference between the mass of the black hole and its irreducible mass. So for the extremal case, we just have this quantity, which numerically something like 29% of the black hole mass. It's actually a pretty good fraction of the black hole's mass is associated with this energy of rotation. And you know, if you think of something like a stellar mass black hole, that's actually an enormous amount of energy. Like if you plug in, say, a black hole of order solar mass or something, it'd be something like, I think, 10 to the 47 joules would be associated with this rotational energy. So, you know, that's kind of one of the reasons we suspect that these very energetic astrophysical events are associated with rapidly spinning black holes. They can kind of power that. So we'll mention that again in a little bit.
Also, in the first case, when we came up with that formula, we said to, means like in the previous lecture, mm-hmm. we said this would be true because we chose the killing vector that becomes null at the horizon. And then we multiply, we said the momentum contracted with that killing vector should be negative. That statement, I was not very sure. How does that come up? You said that if something has to fall in, then the momentum contracted with that killing vector should become negative.
Yeah, so that was like, that's basically saying that, you know, you have this future pointed vector that becomes null on the horizon, and you kind of think, or And then out, like just a little bit away from the horizon, you have like a time-like Killing vector, then and you can track it with that. That'll basically give you something like the energy measured by, you know, as measured by that observer. So it had better be negative if it's actually, you know, have like a time-like geodesic that's carry, you know, future pointed, that's carrying positive energy as measured by some any observer. Yeah, exactly.
And also what I was surprised last time is when we computed the efficiency, it seemed the efficiency was just 21% maximum or something like that. So all the sci-fi things were thinking of extracting energy is not very feasible, I think, right? It's because you need to send in that much energy if you want to extract something like this amount. So you also need to send in that much to be able to get 21% of it outside.
Yeah, it's not like orders of magnitude. Yeah, so that was for that particular Penrose process. So I'll mention some other examples of this kind of general idea, but the generalized Penrose process for extracting black holes. So that's not necessarily the maximum you could get. But yeah, you're true. It basically all these ways of just, you know, sending in something, getting something back out, are kind of order one efficiency, not like orders of magnitude. Yeah, we'll mention briefly how one might actually have an instability associated with this, with the black hole spin, in which case you can start with something small that would grow. But that's a little bit different. But yeah, you're exactly right. Any other questions? Okay, so this area increase law that we wrote down, you know, probably reminds you of something from thermodynamics, right? So it's basically something like the second law of thermodynamics, where here we've traded the area of the black hole for the entropy. So what we're gonna talk about in class today is actually the sort of the black hole thermodynamics and the black hole versions of the, you know, these laws of thermodynamics. So we're not going to really get into this in this class, but you know, in fact, Bekenstein and Hawking taught us that the entropy associated with the black hole is actually just the area of the black hole up to this factor of, 1 over 4 h bar. You need quantum mechanics to actually, you know, derive that factor. But you know, just stated like this, we can think of, so far we have the second law. So now we're going to try to derive for the other laws of black hole thermodynamics. In particular, we'll start with the zeroth law. So the zeroth law states that if an object is in thermal equilibrium, then its temperature is constant. So we need to sort of come up with an equivalent of temperature for black holes. So to do that, we're going to use this vector, which we I've seen many times already now. So this is the Killing vector. It becomes null on the black hole horizon. Again, this is just the horizon frequency of the black hole. So since this is null at the horizon, so yeah, just in pictures, and I think, you know, here's our black hole horizon, and this is sort of the null vector that's future pointing and is orthogonal to the surface. And since all along here, This quantity is constant, in particular at zero. That means that if we take a gradient of it, this is not, it's going to change orthogonal to the surface. So the gradient will actually point in the direction of chi. And so here I've just introduced, you know, some function which I'm calling kappa, which is going to turn out to be the surface gravity of the black hole. And we'll get to why justifying that statement in just a second. If you do a little bit of algebra, in particular, use the fact that this IA is orthogonal to the horizon. And it's a Killing vector, so you use Killing's equation. There's a sort of nice way to write, you can rewrite this equation explicitly in terms of kappa, and you get something like this minus sign. Okay. And this is evaluated at the horizon. So we do a little bit of algebra to take the just take some derivatives of the metric functions. Be a little bit careful because our coordinates are, you know, kind of singular at the horizon. But just plug through that for our curved black hole, and you get an expression like this. And you'll notice that this quantity actually doesn't depend on theta. So it's actually constant on the black hole horizon. And so that's going to justify why we're going to associate this surface gravity with the temperature of the black hole and claim that the black hole, in that sense, has constant temperature. I should note that I did this explicitly for, you know, the Kerr black hole, but you can actually show that if you just assume you have some black hole and that it's stationary spacetime, the vacuum solution, then an asymptotically flat, then in general this kappa will always be constant on the black hole horizon. Though, since sort of the only solution to those conditions is the Kerr black hole, that's kind of equivalent. You don't have to explicitly use the fact that it's a Kerr solution to derive that. So yeah, now we're going to sort of, so let's go ahead and write down our zeroth law of thermodynamics. And that's that the surface gravity kappa is constant on a stationary black hole horizon. All right. And yeah, so now let's kind of briefly justify calling this the surface gravity. So to do that, we're just gonna restrict to a Schwarzschild black hole. So set the spin to zero. Sorry, what's that?
I'm slightly confused by that expression. Kaye is zero. How is the covariant derivative of that non-zero just becomes.
So it's zero, but its derivative is not necessarily zero, right? So it's zero at the horizon, but you have to consider the gradient of it, right? How it changes off the horizon.
That is the relation between this zero law and thermodynamics zero law, because in thermodynamics we say we have two systems, A and B. If I put them together, if they are in equilibrium, nothing between them changes, right? This is the definition of temperature. So how we can see the analogy here? I can see the second law.
There's a couple of different ways to phrase the zeroth law, right? But say the one that's kind of the easiest to make the analogy here is that a body in thermal equilibrium will have constant temperature, right? And so if the black hole is kind of in equilibrium, it's stationary, and in particular stationary, then its horizon temperature, which is what we're calling the surface gravity, should be constant.
It's kind of like we say a system in equilibrium, every point on the surface has the same temperature, something like that.
Exactly, yeah. That, like, if the horizon basically had like variations in its surface gravity, then it would be out of equilibrium and it wouldn't be stationary. Yep, good questions. All right, any more questions? All right, so now we're going to just, for illustrative purposes, set the spin to zero, in which case if we take this expression for kappa, we just get 1 over 4m for Schwarzschild. So let's consider a static observer in Schwarzschild. So that's one where it's basically just sitting at a point. We can write the four velocity of that observer as like this, where this v is the redshift factor. So explicitly, that's this is the inverse redshift factor, and all the other components are zero. Just moving through time, not moving in the spatial coordinates. And then v would be the, you know, if you had some photon that was emitted at that point with a frequency omega, then at infinity it would correspond to frequency v times omega. And you note that as we approach the horizon of the Schwarzschild black hole, this v goes to zero. So now let's calculate the acceleration of this static observer. So do the explicit calculation, we get something like this, which is zero. We have a stationary observer. Basically, you just pick up a R component here. Sorry. Here we get this, which by the normalization is this one. And that means we just get this one Christoffel symbol. And So now if we take the magnitude of this acceleration, let me just get this. So not surprisingly, as we go to the horizon, this acceleration becomes infinite. You need a sort of infinite acceleration to keep some particle hovering at the black hole horizon from falling in. However, if we consider instead the redshifted acceleration, then which we'll define to be v times a, then that redshift acceleration will actually be finite. So let's go here. So B times A is just going to be this. And if we evaluate that at our horizon, then no surprise, we get surface gravity. So this is the definition of the surface gravity for these stationary space and the Schwarzschild, but not necessarily the Kerr. So sort of physically, you can. So yeah, we're sort of defining here the surface gravity to be the redshifted acceleration you need to keep a particle just hovering at the black hole horizon. So very hand wavy, you can think of it if you have some sort of infinitely thin, infinitely strong fishing wire or something like that you attach to a particle. You're lowering it down to the black hole, and then at infinity, you're seeing how much force you have to apply. At infinity to keep that particle hovering there. So at the horizon, this acceleration is blowing up. Sort of the once you redshift that work you have to do all the way to infinity, you get a finite value. And that's how we're defining surface gravity here. So once we generalize to the Kerr case, not assuming that we have static spacetimes. Then you can't just hold something at the horizon, it also has to rotate. As you can't just have a static particle at the horizon. We're still gonna call this kappa as I've defined it generally over there. We're gonna call it the surface gravity. So any questions about that?
For the Kerr black hole, this along with this amount of acceleration, we'll need some rotation, you're saying, to keep it hovering at the horizon. But what did you say?
So I'm saying you can't have a four velocity that just has the time component at the horizon. Because as we argued, once you go into the ergosphere, you have to rotate.
For extremal black holes, that's zero.
Yes, that's a very good point. We'll get there. Okay. You're anticipating one of our other laws of thermodynamics.
Okay.
Yeah. So just hold that thought. Any other questions? Okay. All right, so we have second law, we have the zeroth law. So next, let's do the first law. So I think we basically already have that. If we just take the expression that I just erased for the change in the black hole's area and rearrange it. So, and now and actually use this definition of kappa here. So this is just the expression I wrote down before for the change in the black hole's area. But now I've replaced the term with kappa and just rearranged it a little bit. And so this should remind you of the first law. So you know, here's the energy. We said we're calling the surface gravity, that's our temperature, basically. And this is going to be our entropy. And then this is basically the PdV work. So that again sort of reinforces this identification of the kappa with the temperature. All right, so finally, I'm going to do the third law. Yep, that's the expression there. Yeah, so I mean, there's a couple different ways to state that the third law, but one of them is that it's impossible to achieve t equals zero by a physical process. So for black hole thermodynamics, that must mean the sort of equivalent is that it's impossible to go to kappa equals zero. And as you just pointed out, this kappa actually goes to zero exactly when the dimensionless spin goes to one. So we have extremal solution. So we've already mentioned a couple of times about how the extremal black hole solutions are kind of pathological in the sense that the horizon actually disappears and you get a naked singularity. And actually in the first homework, you'll sort of work through an example of how if you start sort of just below extremal and then try to consider some process to spin up the black hole past extremality, that really the it sort of seems in all situations that people have tried that that the black hole kind of resists that happening. So you can think of that as a kind of another version of cosmic censorship for rapidly spinning black holes. So now we have 0, 1, 2, 3 laws of thermodynamics. Any questions about that?
How do you explain intuitively? Because I'm thinking that now I have a star that has reduced spin equals to 10. It's rotating incredibly fast. And that eventually will collapse. And intuitively, if I think on a collapse process, I expect that to accelerate the spin, not to slow it down. But this is telling me that that spin has to slow down below 1.
Yeah, I mean, so as long as you're below extremality, you can continue to spin the black hole up.
Start with a star that has, for its mass, a spin that is greater than 1.
Yeah, yeah. So for Newtonian value objects, no problem having this dimensionless spin that's greater than 1.
When it collapses, the object has to slow down while it collapses.
Well, you can kind of think of it as you have all this angular momentum, right? So the star is very big, sort of compared to what the horizon size of a black hole would be, right? And so if you wanted to collapse all that angular momentum down to a very small radius, you can kind of think of the fact that the angular momentum, you know, like the centrifugal barrier, if you will prevent the fact that it's rotating very rapidly. It's going to want to oppose kind of squishing down all that angular momentum to very small radii, right? Like there'll be a angular momentum barrier, right, at small radius. You know, for the star to form a black hole, basically going to need to throw off some angular momentum. So maybe part of it, you know, part of the star explodes and the rest collapses or something like that. But, you know, basically it's the angular momentum that's like preventing it from being squished down to very small radiuses, which is what you need to actually form a black hole or for material to fall into the black hole horizon. Good question. Any other questions? Okay, so like in the last lecture, we talked about this particle primrose process of breaking up a particle within the ergosphere. And I mentioned that was actually a particular case of sort of a very generalized set of processes we call generalized primrose processes of ways to extract energy from a black hole. So the particle one is sort of the first one that the primrose wrote down as an illustration that it's possible to do that, but might not be the most sort of astrophysically relevant one. So we'll kind of do the more general case now. So what we're going to do is just consider some type of matter that's going to have a flux through our black hole horizon. We'll just parameterize that matter with the stress energy tensor EAB. We're going to ignore back reaction spacetime. So just considering on the fixed background of our per black hole, we have some test fields, essentially. Okay, so we can use the fact that we have our filling vector associated with our stationary spacetime to construct a conserved current. Just by contracting the stress energy with that Killing vector, so we can check that this is conserved in the sense that its divergence is 0. So we just do this here. So this term, anyone tell me why this term is zero?
That is diffeomorphism invariant, the first.
Sorry, say that again.
That is just diffeomorphism invariant, right? Delta A, TAB to be 0, because we always have G delta A of GAB equal to 0 in the Einstein equation by construction. So the right hand side also should satisfy that.
Yeah, and but what's this? So this should be 0.
Yeah.
What's that called? That's just. That's just the stress energy conservation. So yeah, that's just that our matter should, energy momentum should be conserved. That's zero, and then.
One term is symmetric, another is anti-symmetric by Killing's equation.
Yeah, exactly, and this one is zero by Killing's equation. So this whole thing is just zero. So indeed, this is a conserved current. Okay, so let's apply Stokes' theorems to this.
Of that stress energy tensor on the metric, since you are probably constructing it on the background metric, that first term would not be zero in principle, right?
No. So in general, you should still have stress energy conservation, even if you're not including back reaction. But if you include the stress energy, then you won't have just a Kerr solution, right? You'll have a Kerr. So you have to solve the Einstein equations, including...
If you do it in a perturbative scheme, let's say you have G equals G naught plus H, where H is small, then GT, you're going to construct it based on G naught, which is Kerr for you. But that delta is the delta of the full metric. Therefore...
No, T is constructed by the matter.
Yeah, but like, are you constructing... If you think
any
of...
That it has on the metric, your G plus H, the
yeah.
delta of that whole thing is zero.
Yeah.
So delta of right hand side will be zero.
But T knows about the metric. Are you defining T is the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the metric? Which metric are you putting there? The full G or just the background? If you just put the background, that.
Right. So in general, you always want to have energy conservation, even. You have some like fully general dynamical black holes with matter and stuff like that. I mean, like, as we mentioned, these are kind of independent statements, but basically just from Einstein's equations, right? If I apply a covariant derivative here by the Bianchi identity, I'll get zero. So I better get zero here. I better have my matter better satisfy best energy conservation, right? Otherwise, I don't even have. I can't even have a solution to the Einstein equations. But here I'm ignoring the fact that, you know, I have a vacuum solution, right? The Kerr black hole. I'm just ignoring the fact that if I have some extra matter around, that would perturb the Kerr metric. We're just considering test fields for that case. Okay, so we're going to apply Stokes' theorem to this conserved current. so this is just Stokes' theorem. So here I'm saying I have some manifold N, which I'm integrating this quantity over, and then I can convert that integral to an integral just over the boundary of that manifold delta M. And here NA is going to be the unit normal defined by this delta M. And and this gamma here is the induced metric in this delta M. We get by restricting the metric there. So we're going to choose a particular section delta M. It's going to be bounded by the black hole horizon on one side, and then do two slices of constant time, and then we're going to extend it to infinity on the other side. Let me draw the picture there. So black hole horizon here. We'll call this time, this t initial slice, final time slice, and then this will correspond to infinity. Right, so the unit normals along this delta M. So here we just have NA. Unit normal to slices of constant time. Here we have minus NA. And here we actually have minus this chi A. Where chi A is normal to the horizon, but in its future directed. And so here we're taking the opposite of it. So using this particular manifold, we get the following. Right, so here we're basically and we're gonna put the contribution here on the other side. So you know this is zero just because that whole expression is zero. We have this whole thing is zero here, and then we're gonna put two contributions on this side, and then we're assuming there's no matter going to infinity, escaping it, since our boundary extends all the way to infinity. We just need the contribution here. And so this is the unit normal to slices of constant time. So just as a time component for the lower indices. So this whole thing is actually just that. And so we can basically write this as this term here. Is basically just the energy integrated on this t final slice. This one is just the energy integrated on this t initial slice. And how much they've changed from t initial to t final is basically how much energy has been absorbed through the black hole, the flux through the black hole horizon. These are basically just definition of these terms. So we can repeat the exact same thing with our other Killian vector associated with axisymmetry. So we have this conserved current as well. And exact same argument as energy conservation. And if we just do the same thing here, but for angular momentum, we get that, again, the difference in the angular momentum from T initial to T final is just going to be due to flux of energy into the black hole. Any questions about that? Okay, so we're gonna now invoke an energy condition, in particular, again, the null energy condition. And we're gonna use this chi A as our null vector. So the null energy condition says that if we take our stress energy tensor and contract with any null vector, we better get something that's greater than or equal to zero. And if we use chi A, and we get some expression that involves both this energy flux and angular momentum flux. So we can integrate this condition over the black hole horizon. And you know, using the fact that we made this definition here, we just integrate this inequality for both this guy and this guy. We just get that. So does that look familiar to anyone? Or did I write it too illegibly? So this is just the same condition we had for the particle Penrose process, and now it's for the flux of energy and angular momentum through the black hole. So it turns out this is a very general condition, not just for geodesics, but for any sort of matter that obeys this null energy condition. So, yeah, so, this sort of generalized Penrose process, there's a lot of different versions of it. So we already saw the particle one. Tomorrow we'll talk about one called super radiance associated with scattering waves out the black hole. Perhaps the sort of most astrophysically relevant one is called the Blanford-Zenayak mechanism, which is a way of tapping into a black hole's rotation energy using magnetic field lines that are basically forced to rotate with the black hole. So we'll mention maybe a little bit more about that tomorrow, but I'm running out of time. So let me just stop here.